This is an ABC podcast.
Malole le, fatalo fatu, and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Kwao egitupo, and we'd like to give acknowledgement to the traditional owners and custodians of the lands of which our show comes to you, from the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. On the show today, pro-independent front FLNKS gather for serious talks in New Caledonia, but cracks are starting to show. Tonga's new Prime Minister finally announces his new cabinet, and Marshall Islands has created its first National Marine Sanctuary. More on those stories shortly, but I say whakaoe lahi. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Minaka, welcome back to Pacific Beat. Firstly, there are fears in Kiribati that New Zealand might stem the flow of development aid. This is due to a diplomatic spat between President Denis Mamau and New Zealand's Foreign Minister Winston Peters. It follows the cancellation of a meeting between the two leaders in what would have been the first meeting between the two countries in 5 years. Mamau said he has a significant historical event that's on his home island to attend in instead. However, Kiribati's opposition leader fears he was influenced by other factors. Carl Evans with more.
Pacific hymns and traditional dance, a warm welcome indeed for Kiribati President Denis Mamau, who touched down in Fiji yesterday for diplomatic talks. It was much warmer treatment than Mamau gave to New Zealand's foreign minister, according to Tessie Lamborn, Kiribati's opposition leader.
The Kiribati values its relations with its partners, all of its partners. Well, we have had some concerns over the years with how the current government manages relations with our partners.
Those concerns grew earlier this month when Mamau cancelled a scheduled visit by Winston Peters on short notice. It was to be the first in 5 years between the two countries, and Lamborn fears it was the last straw.
There have been, they call it radio silence from our governments for a long time. There have been, there's been some difficulties with some of the diplomatic staff, visa, and I guess some changes to how this government handles or manages relations with our partners. And our observation is that it seems like the government is, I guess, not managing some of the relations as well as expected, and maybe some of the relations it's managing quite well.
You might have guessed which relationships she's referring to.
What we have seen with the government's decisions, it seemed to have favoured China. Or they seem to have gone out of their way to accommodate China's interests. And that's how we interpret what's been happening over the years. I strongly suspect that they are being influenced in some way or another.
In 2019, Kiribati switched diplomatic recognition from Taiwan to China. Since then, relations with New Zealand and even Australia have been a bit strange, according to John Frankel, a professor of comparative politics at Victoria University in Wellington.
There's still a reluctance to engage with traditional partners. In fact, there was a suspension of all diplomatic visits ahead of the election in August last year, which doesn't really seem to have been dropped at all. No top-level diplomat has been to Kiribati since, I think, Penny Wong in early 2023.
John says this lack of engagement, as well as the latest slight on the New Zealand foreign minister, is starting to take a toll. This week, Peters announced a review into New Zealand's development aid programs in Kiribati, saying New Zealand could not commit to ongoing monetary aid after three cancelled or postponed visits in recent months.
The question is whether the Kiribati government and the president in particular is disturbed by these kind of things. After all, there isn't a large civil society groupings that would jump up and down about some of these kind of things. There's not an independent media. There's a government-controlled radio station. Kiribati is a very scattered country with a lot of people living on offshore outer islands that makes it difficult to put significant pressure on the government in Tarawa.
Other experts say the president should be concerned. Dr. Graham Smith from the Australian National University's Department of Pacific Affairs says this New Zealand government might not be as forgiving as previous administrations.
Pretty out there sort of snub, but certainly for a politician like Winston Peters and for a political party that has, sort of has reducing aid funding as part of its agenda, it's probably a bit of a bad move from Mamau if he values his assistance, because they could well cut it off.
New Zealand committed more than $102 million in aid funding to Kiribati between 2021 and 2024. If they were to turn the tap off, so to speak, Kiribati's opposition leader, Tessie Lambourne, says it would hurt her country badly.
There are lots of ongoing programs that are very critical for our people. New Zealand is funding our Bessel Hospital and some renovation for our main hospital. And that's something that our people really need. I just hope that this doesn't get affected by the review. Earlier this year, the scholarships for our students, the labour mobility programs in New Zealand, and there are a lot of other projects that we ongoing projects with New Zealand that we're just worried that they might be affected.
And that is Kiribati's opposition leader Tessie Lambourne ending that report by Carl Evans. We head to New Caledonia, where the pro-independence front, the FLNKS, have held their annual congress. It was an important meeting, with the FLNKS agreeing to participate in talks with the French government about independence. But the gathering also highlighted cracks within the pro-independence camp. Well, for more on the political developments in New Caledonia, we have Islands business correspondent Nick McLennan joining us this morning. That I say good morning, Nick.
Good morning, Aggie.
Appreciate your time this morning. Nick, look, deciding to go to France for talks about sovereignty, it's a pretty significant move. Would all the members of the FLNKS have agreed to this, or would have been a tough decision to make?
Well, there are significant debates within the independence movement about the way forward. And indeed, since a previous congress of the umbrella body, the FLNKS, there have been debates and divisions within the movement. Two key parties, Palika, the Party of Kanak Liberation, and UPM, have disagreed with other groups and have suspended their involvement in the coalition. They propose to go to negotiations with both the French state and the Loyalist and anti-independence parties about a new political statute. Everyone's been waiting for this Congress, which brings together the largest independence party, Union Caledonienne, the Labour Party, and many other smaller pro-independence forces, as they debate their attitude to these pretty crucial negotiations. Now the FLNKS has forged a common position about how they'll deal, firstly in bilateral talks with the French government, and then potentially with all the other partners in New Caledonia.
Nick, what are, you talk about the debates within the FLNKS, and of course Palika and UPM having to separate themselves. Does this sort of weaken the FLNKS front itself?
There's always been debates within the broad nationalist movement, and indeed within New Caledonia's Congress, there are two pro-independence parliamentary groups. For decades, both Palika and UPM have campaigned for elections under the banners of UNI, the National Union for Independence. Union Caledonienne, the oldest and largest political party, has had its own parliamentary group with some of the smaller groups as well. So this is a long-standing debate within the movement. It came to a head with reactions over the crisis last year, 6 months of clashes between Kanak protesters and French security forces, the enormous economic damage that's occurred because of the upsurge of protests last year, and those debates continue. Having said that, all pro-independence parties still want a pathway to independence, even if there is a period of what's called partnership with the French state, and that's what's on the table at the moment.
So then,
everyone's got to negotiate a new political statute to replace the Noumea Accord, which was signed more than a quarter of a century ago. But those talks have been hamstrung for months, indeed years, because the French state is reluctant to acknowledge that that right to self-determination, the right to create a pathway on a new political future, a pro-independence future, should be on the table.
Yeah. And as you say, as long as this has been going on, why do you think then the FLNKS has decided that now is the time to push ahead with these talks?
Well, there's a timetable ticking. Provincial elections, so the elections for the three provincial assemblies and the National Congress of New Caledonia were due to be held in May last year, May 2024. Those have been pushed off now till the 30th of November this year. Because of the crisis last year, the French state decided that they couldn't hold the elections. And to hold those elections, though, in November, there needs to be major legislative changes to the voting rights, to, setting up the ballot boxes, all the legal things that have to be done by the French government. So France has announced that any deal must be sorted out by the 31st of March. Now, that's not that far away, and there are still some very complex and divided issues. And this is where the FLNKS Congress is so important. They've said that key leaders want to speak directly with France, bilaterally, travel to Paris to meet with the French government under Prime Minister François Bayrou to talk about this question, not just of, domestic affairs, but also about a pathway to independence. Obviously, the loyalist parties are critical of that idea. They want tripartite talks between supporters and opponents of independence and the French state. The FLNKS has also said that they want their nominal president, Christian Tain, to be involved in the talks. People may remember that Tain, one of the organisers of the protests last year, is currently in jail in France. He was elected as FLNKS president last August. Now, that's pretty symbolic, given that he's in pre-trial detention on a jail near the German border. So there's a whole range of stumbling blocks for people to come together, yet France has sent what I regard as a very difficult timeline to have everything sorted out by the end of March.
Yeah, well, let's get into that because, yeah, Christian Tain, the FLNKS are seeming to think that he could lead the talks, and as you say, he's currently facing court in France. But, yeah, how practical is that condition?
Well, it has happened before. As the riots and conflict erupted in May last year, May 2024, Emmanuel Macron, the French president, flew to Nouméa for talks with contending parties. And during that meeting, he invited Christian Tain into the room. And so the FLNKS leaders met with the French president, with Tain at that time, even though he was regarded by the French authorities as one of the instigators of the riots and the damage that was caused at that time. Tain has since been charged with very serious offences. He hasn't been brought to trial, and so the presumption of innocence is still there until the trial comes. But he's regarded not just by the conservative anti-independence parties, but also by people like the leaders of Palika as one of the key instigators of the violence that occurred last year. But the very fact that the FLNKS last year chose him as their president is a symbol, really, of the intransigence of their position. And that's what's angering loyalist leaders like Sonia Bakis, the president of the Southern Province, who says she'll never talk to the man. So there's, as I say, there's a lot of difficult steps that have to come together. There has been talks over the last few years. A broad framework about the way forward has been thrashed out, but there are some real stumbling blocks. And one problem is there's a level of chaos in France as well. President Macron, since his election in 2017, has churned through six prime ministers. The previous Barnier government lasted 90 days, and François Bayrou, the current prime minister, doesn't have the numbers in the French legislature. He has to rely on negotiations both with the left and the extreme right Rassemblement National. There's a whole lot of moving parts in this context. And I think the real challenge is, if a deal can't be struck quickly, and that's possible, but not locked in, then there'll be a level of chaos further on in the year. And that has regional implications, given the economic damage and the impact that it had on the Pacific Islands Forum.
Wow. Nick, you're talking about the talks that could take place in France. FLNK is actually calling for it to be in New Caledonia, rather. Is that more practical?
Yeah, there's been a long tradition of the French state inviting New Caledonia leaders to Paris. And from leaders I've interviewed, both Loyalist and FLNKS in past years, there's a certain isolation there just because of the time difference between, a European country on the other side of the world and the South Pacific. It's quite difficult for leaders involved in negotiations to talk to their counterparts back in Noumea. France has home ground advantage. They can isolate the leaders from their, advisors. They can, pressure people who come to snap decisions. And that's been the case going back to the days when the late Jean-Marie Chabal signed the Matignon-Oudinot Accords in 1988 to end the conflict that racked New Caledonia during the mid-1980s. And that was a concession, the famous handshake with the right-wing leader Jacques Lafleur that led to Jabal's assassination. So that history weighs on people about the difficulties of doing deals in Paris without having people behind you. And I think that's a real problem. Last year showed that most Indigenous Kanaks still want a pathway towards a new political future. They want a pathway to independence. Most non-Kanak don't. Most non-Kanak people want to stay with the French Republic. There are variations and nuances in all of those positions, and it will take time to sort out. And this is a problem. The clock is ticking, and we've seen over many years trying to rush the Melanesian Kanak people to a decision doesn't work. And there needs to be mechanisms on the ground to rebuild trust and move forward. And I'm not sure that President Macron, who has his own clock ticking, he's only got 2 years till the end of his presidency, is the man to deliver this solution. But there's talks going on behind the scenes. There's a lot of dialogue. 10,000 people left New Caledonia last year because of the crisis, mostly French nationals. The economy's in terrible shape. People know that there has to be a deal. Will France buckle and accept that there needs to be ongoing dialogue about independence? Time will tell.
Definitely time will tell. And I liked how you had just said there that, these talks will hopefully create a clear pathway for sovereignty and independence for New Caledonia. But I want to end off here, Nick, in asking if NKS are no longer in position of power within the New Caledonia government, given the new Congress president is pro-independence, how will this affect the push for independence?
Well, the collapse of the government led by President Louis Mapou, a member of Palika, on Christmas Eve last year, was a blow to both tendencies within the independence movement. The current president, Alcide Ponga, who came into office just earlier this month. He's a president of the Rassemblement Party, the historic anti-independence party. That gives advantages, obviously, to the loyalist bloc. And they, as I say, they've been very strong that they don't want to talk to Christian Town. They want to negotiate under certain conditions. They too, though, face the challenge of addressing many of the economic, social, cultural problems created by the conflict last year. The government of New Caledonia is a multi-party government, although the anti-independence parties have 6 members, so a majority in the 11-member government. There are still 5 members of the FLNKS and UNI in the government. And so, You know, the status quo remains. New Caledonia's institutions are still in place. They have their assemblies, their Congress, their government. They continue until the next elections in November. But this is an issue that isn't over. The conflict and violence that we saw in the middle of last year has ended. It's pretty calm and secure last time I was there. But it's still unresolved. And the underlying drivers of conflict, a lot of which are economic and social, poverty and urban instability and so on, those drivers of conflict haven't gone away. And this is where it's a challenge, as I say, for neighbouring countries in the Melanesian Spearhead Group and the Pacific Islands Forum, who sent a very high-level delegation there last October to say there is a role for dialogue, for Talanoa, the Pacific Way, to resolve this. Will the French state listen to those voices? We can only hope.
Absolutely, yeah. Still so much more to unwrap with this situation. But Nick, we always appreciate your time this morning. Merci beaucoup.
Aggie, thank you for the time. Speak to you again.
No worries. That is Island Business correspondent Nick McLennan joining us this morning.
Pacific Beat.
Well, Tonga's new Prime Minister, Aisake Eke, has announced his cabinet. It comes more than a month since he was elected by Parliament to replace the former Prime Minister, Siausi Sovaleni Huakawamiliku, who resigned in the face of a petition of a no confidence. All members of Sovaleni's cabinet have been replaced and removed from their ministerial roles.
The new cabinet will commence today, January 28th, 2025. The new ministers will now assume their roles. The caretaker government has fulfilled its responsibility.
All ministerial appointments require royal consent, and out of the 11 appointees are three non-cabinet members, they being a practitioner, Dr. Anna Akauola, as Minister for Health, and agricultural scientist Siwa Halavatau as Minister for Agriculture, Food and Forests. The other is the Crown Prince Tupoutoa Ulukalala. He replaces his father, King Tupou VI, as Minister for Defence and Minister for Foreign Affairs. It's a portfolio which has traditionally been held by the monarchy, an effect which has been the subject of criticism from many political reformers. Over the years, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs has seen power clashes between the monarchy and the Prime Minister's office, the most recent being last year's rift between the former Prime Minister Huakawamiliku and the King. The former Prime Minister had appointed himself as Foreign Minister, and a rift became public when he rebutted a royal letter indicating the King had no confidence in the Prime Minister holding position of Foreign Minister. It's this rift that's been widely attributed for a petition of no confidence that led to Huakawamiliku's resignation. Negotiations around the Crown Prince's appointment are unknown, but it's an obvious soft spot for critics to target Prime Minister Eke and his cabinet. And with elections to be held in November, the new government will be under pressure to win or maintain public support.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, please be aware that the following story does discuss the topics of rape and sexual assault, so discretion is advised. We head to Guam now, where a bill seeks to provide emergency contraception to rape survivors. Guam has the second highest number of rapes per capita in the United States. Now, the bill, if passed, would mandate emergency health facilities to provide the option of the morning after pill to all rape patients at risk of pregnancy. So joining us this morning is Senator William Parkinson of the 37th Guam Legislature. With that, I say good morning, Senator. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Good morning and half a day. Thank you for having me here today. It's a real pleasure.
Appreciate it. Well, look, Senator, Guam has the second highest number of rapes per capita in the United States. That in itself is an issue. Why have these numbers just grown so much in your country?
Honestly, that is a great mystery to us as well. We're trying to figure out what is happening here, because we have so many sexual assaults here, and the real disturbing thing is in 2020 about 75% of them were minors. And so this really highlights the vulnerability of our youth here and the necessity for something like this.
Yeah. And before we get into the bill itself, Senator, you know, for our listeners, for some who may not understand what a morning after pill is, are you able to break that down? What does this pill specifically do?
The morning after pill, just to be very clear, is not is not an abortion pill. This this bill is or this I'm sorry this bill this this pill prevents pregnancy, but it is not an abortion pill. So for those people who are confused about that, that's what the emergency contraception does. Because I know I've had questions over here where people had thought that this was an abortion pill of some sort. And so, you know, I just wanted to clear that up for the people listening over there, that this prevents pregnancy immediately after, but it is not an abortion.
Okay. Well, thank you for clarifying that. Now, when I came across this story, I was wondering, was emergency contraception not even available before this bill was introduced?
No, we as a matter of executive policy, a lot of the non-government agencies and nonprofits and stakeholders that are partners with us in this, they do this as a matter of practice. But I'm a big believer that we do not pass laws for governors and legislatures that are friendly to our political beliefs, but we pass them for the times we are no longer in office, and we want to make sure that these practices are codified and made permanent and are not changed capriciously by the change of administration.
Mm. Now, this bill that you have has been in the making for a while now, right? I'm wondering what now then needs to get it passed, because why is there a push to really implement such a bill?
Well, the push to implement such a bill really comes from a desire to make sure that all of the people who are victims of such a terrible, terrible ordeal have all the options and tools they need to come back from it. You know, we talked about the emergency contraception, but when we look at what the bill really mandates, it mandates like a process. It mandates a process that when this happens, that they are to get all the information that they need, a clear breakdown of what their options are, the medical facility to provide this emergency contraception, and then for them to also help the victim with resources to aid her in her time afterward, organizations that will help with that help survivors and specialize in that sort of trauma response.
Senator, can you clarify, because some of the stats that I was looking over, and this is right across the Pacific, it says 60% of Pacific Island women who want to avoid or even delay pregnancy are actually unable to do so. And sometimes that's due to misinformation, you know, the stigma that comes with it, or even no access to contraception itself. But when we look at your bill and obviously victims of rape, your bill will effectively give them at least a choice. Is that the case? It's just for them to have the choice that they can take the morning pill or
yes,
not.
Yes. Yeah, of course, because ultimately we're advocates for making sure that the victim has as many options as they can. And it's ultimately the choice of the person and the individual what to do and how to respond to it. And the best we could do is just respect that and be as supportive and kind and empathetic as we can.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Is this the first of its kind for or there in Guam to have to mandate something like this?
Well, I'm not. It is a mandate, but this is something we're already doing. I just want to make sure it gets codified into the future so that when the future comes and I am no longer sitting in this chair and being here to defend it, at least the things I want to defend are enshrined in law and mandated.
Mm. Yeah, and if mandated, does this mean then, Senator, the pill is going to be fully funded for these women, that they can just have easy access to the morning after pill?
Well, generally the way it would work, depending on where the victim would go to. That would kind of determine the funding source for how she gets the emergency contraception. You know, if she goes to a government facility of some type, that will be taken care of. Like the cost for the contraception will be in the budgeting for it. Or if she goes with a nonprofit or a non-governmental agency, that nonprofit or non-governmental agency will have funding for those emergency contraceptions through grants they apply through the government or other funding that helps support the organization.
I had asked earlier, Senator, you know, what's needed to, I suppose, get this bill pushed into the next phase or for it to be passed. With that, though, has there been sort of any pushback to this bill and why?
The pushback I've been getting from the bill is just the misinformation and the misunderstanding of people that think this is an abortion pill and not a morning after pill. This is, just to reiterate again, this is not an abortion pill or of anything like that. This is emergency contraception. I actually do have a separate legislation that tries to tackle the topic of abortion pills. So, I mean, there is a difference in there because I've had to do two different bills for the two different subject matters. But in this case, this is emergency contraception and not an abortion pill.
Okay. And then also to even clarify that this morning after pill is only really for, you know, rape survivors. It isn't just for someone who just doesn't want to be pregnant, right?
Yeah, well, in the greater market, any individual could use the morning after pill if they could get a doctor's prescription, or depending if it's over the counter in your location, whenever they want. But this bill specifically addresses when victims and rape survivors go to receive medical treatment and emergency support, that this mandates that they get access to emergency contraception. Not that they're forced to or anything.
Yeah, and that's the thing. So, of course, they still will at least have the choice whether they want the pill or not, right, if they were to come into an emergency facility.
Absolutely. And ultimately, that's what it is for me, is choice. You know, one of my guiding principles has always been freedom and the freedom to carve out your own destiny. And even in such a trying and horrific time, I want to be able to support women and victims in this moment by making sure that they have all the information, they have a clear list of what their options are, they have access to those options, and then afterward they have guidance towards aftercare for their mental well-being.
Yeah, and that's the biggest thing, isn't it? Having to deal with the mental trauma and afterwards of such an ordeal. Then, Senator, if this gets passed or when it gets passed, is this something you believe should be on offer right across the Pacific region?
Absolutely, absolutely. I know the challenges with sexual assault that Guam is having is not unique to Guam as an island, and many, many island chains all over the Pacific struggle with the same struggle we have. And while we have that struggle, I think it's incumbent and important of us to make sure our people have the options necessary to make the best informed decisions they can for themselves and to have all the options available to them.
Senator, finally, as we wrap up, I'd love to hear, you know, what your message would be this morning to those who, you know, have gone through such a traumatic event and the help that they possibly could get at an emergency facility by taking this morning after pill.
My message to those people would be that I know you're going through a really hard time in your life, and it may sometimes feel like that the world is against you. But I do want you to know that there are people who are kind, empathetic, and care, and will help you if you reach out to them. And I will always be one of those people. And I will always make sure that people that are willing to help will be always empowered to help you.
Well, those are very wise words this morning, Senator. And look, we really appreciate your time this morning for sharing on Pacific Beat.
Thank you so much for having me. Always happy to come on. Thank you so much.
Yes, no worries. That is Senator William Parkinson of the 37th Guam Legislature here on Pacific Beat. Stay tuned because your news wrap is up next.
It's good to relax after a hard couple months work in the Pacific. Hey, Jacob McQuire.
Yes, sir, Michael Chow. We finally finished building new ABC Radio Australia FM transmitters in the Solomon Islands, Manus, Bougainville, and the Cook Islands.
Yeah, so now even more people can enjoy the latest news, sport, music, and entertainment that ABC Radio Australia has to offer.
Hey, guys, get back to work!
Oh, okay, so if you're listening in, kia ora.
Hey, urahandru na traibla, thank you, Stret.
Big fella hamamas, and welcome to all our new listeners on ABC Radio Australia.
Yours in the Pacific.
Hold the front page!
Marlon and Lee, welcome back to Pacific Beat. It is that time we head around the region. We've got your news wrap with producer Finau Fonua. All right, let's get straight into it. Finau, Australia has provided over $17 million for earthquake recovery. Can you tell us a little bit more?
Yes, that's correct. Vanuatu Daily Post reports the Australian government has increased its earthquake response support with $17 million Australian dollars. Mm-hmm. As you know, the earthquake last month killed 14 people, caused a lot of damage. According to the Australian government, the aid package will help restore essential services and infrastructure. This covers key transport routes as well as damaged buildings, including schools, health facilities, and public offices. Australian engineers are currently on the ground, already making detailed assessments of those damaged buildings, no doubt for this aid package.
Absolutely. Okay, well, here we've got a Japanese company. They're exporting green hydrogen from New Zealand to Fiji. What's the details there?
Yeah, this is interesting. Hydrogen Insight reports Japanese company Obayashi Corporation has shipped an unspecified quantity of green hydrogen from New Zealand to Fiji as part of a demonstration project subsidized by the Japanese government. The hydrogen produced at Helkins Power's 1.25 megawatt geothermal powered electrolysis plant near the city of Taupo in New Zealand was loaded into gas cylinders and transported from Auckland to Lautoka in Fiji. Fiji's gas authority has collaborated in this. The fuel was put into a hydrogen generator to fuel a building, so to generate the electricity there. As you know, this is interesting because Pacific Islands have long
depended on oil.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, look, that's all the time we have, though, for Newswrap this morning, Finau, but we do appreciate you coming through here on Pacific Beat. Well, Marshall Islands has created its first national marine sanctuary to protect what's been described as one of the most pristine environments in all of the Western Pacific Ocean. That sanctuary around two remote uninhabited atolls covers 48,000 square kilometres of water that shelter the country's largest green turtle nesting colony, deep sea sharks and warming resistant coral. Even President Hilda Heine said she was proud to announce the area will be protected from fishing and promised it would not be the last sanctuary of its kind. Now, National Geographic Pristine Seas helped provide data to local authorities by surveying marine life in the area down to a depth of 2,000 metres, and this was back in 2023. And now the program's expeditions director, Ryan Jenkinson, joins us now on the line. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Gosh, give us a sense of how significant this area is. And I'm wondering, what did Pristine Seas find during its survey?
Yeah, well, you know, significance for the country of the Marshalls is it's their first national sanctuary in a large area. And the reason they did that is because there was some idea of how special it could be. And what we found was honestly, one of the most pristine reefs systems, especially in the Western Pacific, just absolutely spectacular corals, like you mentioned, giant clams, huge abundances of sharks, large fish. There's not a lot of places in the world like that left, honestly.
It may seem an obvious question, but why should the area be protected?
Yeah, well, there's a couple reasons. Any kind of protection has knockoff impacts, both for the actual ecosystem itself and the life there, but also for people, economically, for food security, and for resilience for what is undeniably a changing planet. So when an ecosystem is protected and an area of the ocean is protected, one of the first impacts that we see over and over around the world is when you let the animals in that area grow and thrive and reproduce, you get more fish in areas outside of it. So you actually get increased amounts of available resources for people outside of protected areas. And so that's one of the most, you know, direct benefits to people. The other thing it does is when events occur, like global warming that leads to warm oceans, and we all hear the stories about bleaching coral all over the world. When the ecosystem's intact, what we've seen is the coral can actually recover from those warm water events relatively quickly. And so by protecting these areas, you build in resilience for the reefs in a given area, in this case, the Marshall Islands.
Ryan, you know, with the expedition that you guys did with Pristine Seas, I understand that the data you would have gathered was used to inform a local. It's a very traditional approach to conservation. I mean, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, the local approach to conservation in the Marshalls is termed Remenlock. And I probably didn't pronounce that perfectly, but it's something that the Marshallese have carried on for hundreds and hundreds of years. And it's the concept of incorporating local traditional knowledge with observations in the water and what people are catching to think about making sure you have resources for a long period of time. So in this case, the marine authority there in the Marshalls, MIMRA, asked us to go to these areas to provide them the data that they can then combine with their traditional knowledge and information as part of their Remenlock process to think about conservation. So really our role was to try to help them out with their own conservation methods in the way that they wanted it done. So we're honestly the lucky recipients of being asked to go to this amazing area.
And I have to ask then, yeah, what does it feel like to be involved in helping a country declare its first marine sanctuary?
You know, there is some personal gratification, of course. You know, this is what myself and our team do for work. But really, I think the most satisfaction that we get out of it is it's not just us who go up there. We have local partners from the Marine Authority with us, and they're diving and they're running the cameras and they're seeing these places. And these are guys who work all over the country. And to see them experience a location like that with abundances of these species like the clams and giant groupers and sharks that they don't see anywhere else, just to see them light up, to see them come up from a dive, to see how excited they are, to know that this is theirs, this is their resource, this is one of the most incredible places on Earth, and it's part of their country and their heritage. To me personally, that is as rewarding as anything else.
Oh, fascinating. Ryan, I do want to also ask, though, you know, Pristine Seas, I know that you study the marine environment even around the Bikini Atoll. You know, we know that's the former nuclear bomb test site. With that, what did you find there?
Yeah, what we were asked to do is, you know, we went to these places, these atolls, Bikar and Bokok, that are untouched and pristine. What if we compared that to a location that had maybe the greatest disturbance by mankind of all time, where a bunch of nuclear bombs over a 10-year period were detonated on this one atoll? And do we see resilience on the reefs even under those circumstances? And so that's why we went there, is to establish a baseline for MIMRA to be able to continue to monitor these locations to watch the regeneration of those reefs. And I can tell you, Bikini Atoll is definitely coming back. We saw fish and live coral and turtles, probably more than we expected. But that being said, there are locations directly adjacent to where some of the bombs were detonated that remain pretty desolate. And the atoll is still not livable by humans.
So then where to from here then, Ryan? Like, what's another expedition that you guys are seeking out?
Yeah, so we just, in 2024, we went to Palau, which was pretty soon after we finished the Marshalls, we sailed out west. And we are actually approaching the final science report and some of the media filming that we do to prepare for Palau to see if we can help them with some of their marine spatial planning. And then last year, we also were able to do expeditions in Papua New Guinea and the Solomon Islands that we're really excited about. So we're just starting to get back some of the data and some of the film stuff from those locations. And we're really excited about the possibility of helping those countries with their conservation work. This year, we're looking forward to visiting Fiji and Tuvalu are some of our locations and countries that we're going to be working with.
It sounds fascinating and exciting. And Ryan, we hope to catch up with you again to find out a little bit more about these expeditions you guys are going to be going on this year. But Ryan, we appreciate your time this morning.
No problem. Next time there's a big announcement, I hope to come back on.
Absolutely. That, of course, is Ryan Jenkinson, Expeditions Director of National Geographic Pristine Seas here on Pacific Beat.
Want to immerse yourself in sport and stories of athletes from across the Pacific? Well, join me, Sam Wykes, alongside some of the most talented journalists and sports commentators from across the region for Fresh Off the Field. Each week, we'll bring you interviews with Pacific athletes leaving their mark on the international stage and those aspiring to do the same. From cricket to netball, athletics to rugby, and everything in between. Fresh Off the Field, Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m. PNG time on Radio Australia.
Here at ABC Radio Australia, we've tripled our Pacific-focused content, which means we're sounding more and more Pacific every day. Tune in across the week to hear a fresh, new lineup of Pacific voices and shows on your favourite subjects like sport, music and culture. Go online to abc.net.au/Pacific to find out more. ABC Radio Australia, yours in the Pacific.
Well, that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Time to take a look back at some of our stories. Fears in Kiribati that New Zealand might stem the flow of development aid due to a diplomatic spat between President Tanesi Mamau and New Zealand's Foreign Minister Winston Peters. Follows the cancellation of a meeting between the two leaders and what would have been the first meeting between the two countries in 5 years. Also, we spoke to Tessie Lamborn, Kiribati's opposition leader, who says the Kiribati government has been selective in its diplomatic relations.
What we have seen with the government's decisions, it seemed to have favored China, or they seem to have gone out of their way to accommodate China's interests. And that's how we interpret what's been happening over the years.
And I'll be back same time tomorrow. That's at 6 a.m. PNG time. But you can check us out this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned because ABC Radio Australia has your news next. Coming up after that, it's Nisha Daly. Until next time, o tō awhātou. This is Pacific Beat.